This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. I was traveling internationally last year. I was in Mallorca. I didn't know the island well. I said, let me head to the north, head towards the water. Let me go on Hotels.com and see what they have available. Something preferably on the beach, maybe even a gym. Not only did I get those things, there was a kids session with exercise, gymnastics in the water, pony rides, a train. It had everything, and I didn't even want any of those things. But at least I knew they were there, just in case I changed my mind. And now finding the perfect hotel has never been easier, thanks to the Hotels.com app. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly, right, all-inclusive, or a relaxing spa weekend, you can find exactly what you need and compare hotel prices, ratings, and amenities side by side. So start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Shouldn't you be at work?
It's a lovely chip! Oh, it's a brilliant goal from Lord Pohino!
Dillick's not away. Southgate's shot. Milosevic scores.
Could do with a bit of magic from him. Maybe this is it. It is Andy Sinton from nothing.
Brian Roy has headed for his interlead.
Whelan. Oh, what a goal from Noel Whelan.
No power on it whatsoever, but Taibbi has made a horrendous error.
Now, you know him better than anybody, probably. Do you back him to score quickly, yes or no?
Yes.
Tony Hatton.
No.
Hello and welcome to Quickly Kevin, Will He Score? I'm Chris Gold. Joining me, Josh Widdicombe.
Hello.
And a man who, to my knowledge, has never died on Championship Manager and in fact once edited the database so that he could live forever like a Highlander. It's Michael Morrow.
There can be only one. Hello.
How are you?
Good.
I'm going to broaden this straight back to 90s football, but when the Dominic Cummings story, I don't know if you've been reading it over the weekend, but did it remind you of Paul Merson's time at Middlesbrough, that journey?
There was a great stat that someone had tweeted that Dominic Cummings' journey to Durham was further than any away game Crewe Alexander have played in their 100-plus year history. Great stat. It's been a real couple of amazing weeks for Crewe Alexander revelations after our Dario G... Dario
so this
Grandi
has gone big, right?
It's gone huge. You know, Dario Grandi's been liking tweets that when listeners mention this.
Really?
Yeah, Dario Grandi's been liking tweets.
Dario Grandi or Dario G?
Sorry, I get him confused now. Dario G.
Dario G. I was going to say Dario Grandi feels like someone who's unlikely to be on Twitter. So Dario G's been liking tweets that our listeners... So what is annoying for me is I've been sitting... You know when you've missed the lead, when a journalist has missed the lead? I've been sitting on a scoop for 3 years. It's like if I'd said, did you know Erinsborough is an anagram of neighbours? And you went, what the fuck? This is the first time I've heard this in my life. That's how kind of...
Hold on.
That is the first time I've heard
That's genuinely the first time I've heard that.
You knew that.
What?
No, of course I didn't. Erinsborough is an anagram of neighbours. You know, that's like the oldest fact from when we were kids.
You say that, but...
How much gold are you sitting on?
Well, far more than I realised.
That's astonishing. I never knew that.
Did you not?
No, that's amazing.
I bet we get hundreds of tweets now tomorrow.
Yeah, saying that you two are idiots. I can't believe that you didn't know that. Yeah, so Erinsborough is an anagram of neighbours.
I'm just trying to think of an anagram for Harold Bishop. I can't think of one.
So Dario G is still a thing. So he's still on Twitter. I didn't realise this because I've re-embraced Twitter in the last 48 hours, but that's for other reasons. But Dario G, he's on Twitter. Is he an active person? What kind of tweets is he sending out?
Well, he's got 900 followers. So
if you're
trying to give him a follow and see what he's up to, he's not got a blue tick.
We should all be following. I'm going to follow him now. He's not got a blue tick.
He's not got a blue tick. which is astonishing. You think he would.
Definitely.
It's definitely him. It's 100% legit.
Oh, he follows me. I might drop him a DM.
Should we get him in?
Should we do it? He'll have a good mic.
Yeah, Yeah, let's do it. If he's a Crewe fan, we've not covered Crewe.
Shall we see him? We just need a 10-minute chat with Dario G about Crewe. Because he did football songs, didn't he? He was involved in France 98 in some way, wasn't he?
Yeah, he did the official song of the France 98 World Cup.
Yeah.
You're not thinking of Jean-Michel Jarre, are you?
You know Jean-Michel Jarre's named after the manager of Port Vale, though.
Could we ask Dario G for like get him on the show, but also maybe remix our theme tune?
Yes, please. Okay. In the week, I'm going to slide into Dario G's DMs. So if you are listening to the show, Dario, I will be doing that. Oh, my God. If I get absolutely ignored by him, it's going to be absolute heartbreak. Right. Let's do some correspondence.
I'm Jim Rosenthal, and this is the Electronic Postbag.
You've got mail.
So, Chris, you joked about it at the start, but our inbox has been full of people who've had football manager deaths. Shall I just take you through them? Luke Manning. Glad someone mentioned the death of a player on Championship Manager, as my mate had a death on 0102, and it's been eating away at me as I've never heard it happening to anyone else. I was there with him when he received the news that one of his youth players, Kalam Muniarak, had tripped over a cone in training and died of his injuries. This can't be true.
Oh, no.
A load of nonsense.
As the years passed, I haven't asked him since in case it was a weird, vivid dream. But there's no reason for me to remember Muniarak and his nomadic lower league football career otherwise. He didn't receive an insurance payout for the death, for what it's worth.
I mean, that's more plausible than Nicolas Anelka, because I feel like if it's a sort of unknown player or a regen, you could get away with doing it. But I don't think you can't kill off Nicolas Anelka. I don't believe that happened.
Tripping over a cone as well. How big's this cone?
So what do you think has happened there? Do you think this has been misremembered?
I think it's a fake memory. I don't think they're misleading us. I think it's something that becomes apocryphal and it's just not true.
Chris Cahill. Michael, by the way, we should have some kind of mournful music under these as well. Could we have the music from Cannon Fodder when they talk about all the soldiers? The topic of the virtually deceased has formed a do-I-remember-this-right quandary for most of my life. And as an innocent 9-year-old playing Champ Man 93-94 on the Amiga 500, guiding Forest to the Premier League promotion with Collymore and Collis leading the attack, I recall a shocking notification popping up stating, Ron Atkinson has died of a heart attack. Aston Villa are looking for a new manager.
This is
that one. No way. On Chapman 93-94, the coding was not complex enough for someone to die.
This
no
has haunted me for 10 years, wondering whether it happened or it was some nightmarish imagination. For a friend at university told me his friend, a friend of his, claimed David Unsworth had died in his game.
This is not true.
Yeah, it's always a friend of a friend who knows someone.
Well, he's had so. So, all right. Do you want more? I can give you more.
Yeah. Do you know what? I'm going to message Miles. I'm going to send Miles a message.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. Yeah. He would know, surely.
Stay tuned. Hopefully he gets back to us before we record the tail end of this episode.
What a couple of things to tune in for. Who's going to reply? Miles Jacobson or Dario G? Here's more evidence from Ian Truman. He says, the correspondence in the last episode has restored my belief in my own faculties. I believe he may have the version of the game wrong, as I'm relatively certain mine occurred on or around CM0102. However, since that fateful day, whenever it was, I've been haunted by a memory that no one else believes and that I can't substantiate, despite every couple of years searching for proof on the internet for evidence that there must be others out there. I now know how UFO abductees must feel, minus the probing and violation. For I, too, have had a player die on Championship Manager. Phil Neville passed away on the virtual operating table.
No.
And I too received a windfall from the insurers to reinvest in the squad. If I recall correctly, it was vastly more than he was worth to me as a backup fullback.
No, I don't believe it.
He ends. Now that I know there are others out there, I implore the makers of the game to admit they've been keeping this secret for too long and that the truth must come out. The truth will set us free.
I think it's a collective false memory. Because I've seen the inbox. There's so many of these emails, tens and tens and tens, and tweets as well. So many people think this happened to them. I can't believe it did. I'm really struggling.
Okay.
There's one more. Michael, you sent a screen grab around of something that we think we were sent on Twitter. I think it appears to be from CMO102, and it's a screenshot of that kind of messaging kind of interface. And it says, are you sure you wish to send Jamie Redknapp to a faith healer? He would be unavailable for matches for a couple of days while attending sessions. That can't be. What is going on?
Has someone doctored that, do you think?
You could be doctored, but also that feels like the sort of thing that, as a programmer, you might have a bit of fun with.
Yeah, well, when we interviewed Miles back in the day, he said that they considered doing aliens, didn't they?
Yeah.
Let's not rule it out. We will investigate. Now, on with Championship Manager, but let's put the dead players to bed to discuss this. On Championship Manager 97-98, so you're playing Championship Manager 97-98, aren't you, Michael?
Yeah, I'm in the middle of a Champman 97-98 tournament run by the guys over at cm9798.wordpress.com. If any listeners fancy some really great nostalgic Champman content, you should check out their blogs.
I vaguely remember this being the case, but I don't know if you knew this. This is from Ollie Rouse. I can't believe this hasn't been mentioned yet. Now I'm starting to think I'm the only person that knows this tactic. In Championship Manager 97-98, you can play with no goalkeeper and have an extra player on the pitch. If you have a left back with high tackling and strength stats, they act as a goalkeeper and also as a left back.
What?
I know this sounds mad, but it's true. Please check this out.
Wow.
I've never heard that.
That's from Ollie Rouse.
Oh, that feels like it could be a hack, because there are often little things that you can do that are kind of match engine beaters, whether it's a formation.
Yeah. I don't think that's like a cheat so much as a thing where it would default and actually it helps you, kind of thing, right?
Yeah. There was a version, I can't remember which one, where you could get your striker to mark the goalkeeper, and he would score like 100 goals a season. It was ridiculous.
But I'm in the middle. Offside.
I know. Look, the coding was fairly simple back then. But I'm in the middle of this tournament, and I lost my first game. I got picked to Sweden. I lost my first game 3-2, but only because I wasn't there. I didn't sign into the Zoom in time. They played a standard 4-4-2. We've just played my second game against Ireland. I was 2-0 down. Ended up winning 5-3 in the end.
Yes, please.
Oh, wow.
So there's a good chance I'll go through from the group stages. That feels like a maneuver that, A, I think my opposing players would strongly object to, but also
they would clock it.
It could blow up horribly in my face as well.
Yeah,
it would be a scandal if you won that tournament without playing a goalkeeper.
Imagine, oh God, me and Chris would have to send out tweets backing you up, saying that you're only protecting your young family.
I'd be doing the 5 p.m. press conference. Get the presentation out, like trying to explain why it was actually a move of genius and not a glitch.
I'm actually here, guys, to talk about the Carlton Palmer episode. I'm not here to discuss Michael's tactics.
Do you know on that version of Champ, though, you don't see the opposition's formation by default, do you? You've got to look at it.
You've got to look, yeah. You've got to check.
You could sneak this under the radar.
It's being played on a kind of shared screen type thing, so they would see it.
Of course, they'd see you tinkering with your formation. And their joy, as they went into the game, would swiftly, like, they'd be like, this guy is an absolute chance, he's forgotten to put a goalkeeper in.
That reminds me, when I played Championship 97-98, first time I became manager of England, I really got rid of the whole squad. I was like, right, I'm going to build this squad fresh. I can't think it was like a bunch of qualifiers. And I picked the team, then got into the first game. And I remember it was Bulgaria away. Went to start picking my team, my 11, and I realised I hadn't selected any goalkeepers for the squad. I started at right back and left back defenders. So I had two games to play. I can't remember who went in goal. I think it was like Andy Sinton or someone went in goal.
Still lasted longer than Sam Allardyce, though. That's the amazing thing as the England manager.
I really weighted it towards the defence. I had like one up top. It was a super tight, really kind of defensive formation. All the kind of the tactics were just defend, and try and get Nick one on the break. And I think I remember winning both of those games.
Oh, that is brilliant. It's like, do you remember when, it's like that classic press conference when Stuart Pearce was the caretaker at Forest. They won their first game and he was like, oh, last night I picked my team. I showed it to my wife and she's like, oh yeah, you haven't picked a goalie. And he picked 11 outfield players.
Wasn't there a game where, am I remembering this right, where Stuart Pearce played David James up front?
Yeah, when he was Man City.
Yeah, I'm sure he did.
I've never understood that. I've actually tried to look into why he did that, but I've never understood why. There's an amazing compilation of his action in that game, and he is atrocious. Nearly gets sent off. It was a bizarre decision.
Yeah, I don't.
Man United used to play Fabian Barthez up front in friendlies.
Did they?
Yeah, because if you just put Fabian Barthez striker into Google, you'll see pictures of him wearing a kit, like wearing the outfield kit, playing up front in friendlies. Because he was on to Ferguson that he really rated himself as a striker.
This is one. I know we've done this with Peter Schmeichel. Was he good?
You won the World Cup.
Fabian Barthez. Was he good? Because I don't remember him ever being good.
I think he was one of those goalkeepers where he was a brilliant shot stopper, but he was very error prone. So he would probably stop goals that another keeper would have conceded.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
In return, he was worth two or three goals a season that every other keeper would have saved.
No great goalkeeper. You can never say they've got a ricket in them about any great goalkeeper. Like that's the one thing you've got to be able to do is be consistent. And for people like David James and Fabian Barthez, that you would be terrified often pairing goal for your team.
Now, I know we've had a lot of controversy and a lot of doubt, but we do need to cover this as well. So this is from an anonymous source who has got the audio of Alex Bruce denying that Steve Bruce wrote the books. Now, we've discussed this before, but when you listen to the audio, I think it's very convincing. Are you ready?
Here I was with a gun close to me and I felt no fear. The situation was unreal. This was Ladysford on Saturday afternoon, not Chicago in the time of Al Capone.
God, I've got this image in my mind of you going to bed at night and your dad reading these novels to you.
No, that definitely didn't happen. I think he was manager of Huddersfield at the time and someone approached him and said, I wrote these books. Can we put your name to it? And he can't take credit for writing anything.
I've got to say, when they said to me this afternoon, we found these books that Steve's written, I went, no chance. And I'm glad you said that.
Yeah.
But what the good news is, you want to tell
me... There you go. What do you think?
Whoa, man. This is the first time I've thought that maybe he didn't write the book.
Michael?
No, I'm still unmoved.
Really?
I understand why he said that, but also I'm presuming that's the interview that he backtracked from a day or so later.
Yes, it is the interview he backtracked from a day or so later.
Yeah, then no. Steve Bruce still wrote those books.
Okay, we will draw a line under it. I guess we will never know. Although I can't remember the name, but I did see someone who said that their friend... Steve Bruce came to the school to give out copies of Striker.
Whoa, okay. Now I'm interested.
Imagine if it made the curriculum. Get rid of Lord of the Flies.
What does Sir Lawrence represent?
It's capitalism. Write your dissertation on this.
Thank you so much for all your emails. We get so many good ones. We do read all of them and we will get to as many as we can, but this is how to get in touch.
Get in touch with the show. Email hello@quicklykevin.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter @quicklykevin and sign up to the mailing list @quicklykevin.com.
All right, coming up next, when I think of 90s football, I think of probably Graham Taylor and that documentary, and I think about Carlton Palmer in midfield wearing an England shirt with a big Three Lions crest and the little tiny crest in the collar. And then I think about him playing for Leeds. He is, for me, the archetypal 90s footballer, and here he is. This is Carlton Palmer. Our guest this week hit the big time as a central cog in the Sheffield Wednesday machine, which regularly found itself at the top of the top flight in the early 90s. He made 18 appearances for England and delivered throughout the 90s as one of the Premier League's best box-to-box midfielders. It's our huge pleasure to welcome to Quickly Kevin, England's own Carlton Palmer.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, happy with that intro?
Yeah, great.
I'm always fascinated by like retired footballers. You tend to stay where you had the best time in your career. Obviously, Steve Ball lives in Wolverhampton. That's not a big surprise. But you still based around the kind of Sheffield region. I know actually you work in Shanghai now. But
yeah, I did have the best time at Sheffield Wednesday. But honestly, it is just a fabulous place to live. Where Lucy and I live, we're about 15 minutes into Derbyshire. So it's great for running, going out that way, great country pubs. It's just a lovely place to live. But Sheffield's just got a nice feel about it. For the first time I went there, I mean, I've been there now, I'm 54, so I've been there over 30 years. And it's just got a nice feel about it.
Yeah. We're fascinated this series with, like, learning about professional football is how good you were at school. How good were you, like, growing up? Were you just way better than everyone else?
No, not really. I wasn't. I mean, football was something that I had to work at. I was fitter. I was by a million miles. I mean, I had unbelievable levels of fitness. But in terms of ability, I wouldn't say that. I think there were a lot of players who had more ability than me. But, you know, in life, to be successful, it takes more than just having ability. And to be the best, you can have ability, and if you don't work hard and apply yourself, then you don't achieve what you're supposed to achieve.
So let's rewind the clock right back to the start of your career. So you start with West Brom in the 80s, and the West Brom are kind of in the second tier then. How was that as an education into the world of football, joining West Brom?
Well, it was hard. It was really hard because I joined on a YTS. They just brought out that YTS scheme. And the coach at the time there, a guy called Ken Hodgkinson, he didn't really fancy me at all. So I was well down the pecking order.
Did you always play in the way you play? Were you always like a kind of central midfielder?
No, I actually started off as a centre-back. That's my position. That is my position. I only ended up playing in midfield because Ron said I had too much energy. But my actual position is a defender.
Yeah.
So this is the way circumstances happen. Johnny Giles got the sack and Ron Atkinson come in, and he brought Nobby Styles in, who was the youth team manager. And from the first day Nobby came to the football club, he just took a shine to me. So he used to take me out for training sessions in the afternoon, in the gym, talk to me about, you know, being long and gainly. He said I was short and everybody thought that I didn't look like a footballer. And he just used to work at things with me, shortening my stride in tyres, skipping in the gymnasium. And then he just said, he told Ron that he thought I would be a player. So Ron extended my contract for, I think, about 3 or 4 months. And Jimmy Nicol was injured coming back from Ireland. And Ron pulled me in on the Friday and said they were playing Birmingham. Oh. Basically, I hadn't played an handful of reserve games, never mind youth team games. And he said, would you bottle it if I put you on Saturday? And of course, you're not. You're going to front it up, aren't you?
No, I'd go, I'm going to bottle that.
Yeah. No, so, and that was it. I played on the Saturday, got man of the match, and the rest is history.
That's straight into West Midlands Derby as well.
Yeah, and that's how quickly things changed for me.
Man.
You know, somebody believing in you, somebody seeing something in you, and then Ron Atkinson, as always, I don't know what it is. We hit it off from day one. I don't know whether, you know, I'm a cheeky chappy, I'm a happy. I'm a very positive person, and Ron likes positive people around him. I you know, if we're 4-0 down, I, you know, with 5 minutes to go, I think we'll win 5-4. That's the type of person I am. You know, I very rarely get down, and I don't look at negative things, and I can't have those people around me. And Ron's similar to that.
Was Ron the character, like, when you work with him, he seemed like he had such a kind of huge character about him from afar. Was it like that to work with him day to day?
Yeah, it was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. He loved football. The thing about Ron is he understood that supporters paid money to come and watch the team play, so he wanted his teams to entertain. We never got bollocking for getting beat. We got bollocking for not trying to play, not trying to entertain. And he's larger than life. He's a great bloke.
Was he larger than life in those West Brom days? Had he evolved into the kind of Ron Atkinson character?
No, I think that was just him. Since I knew him, since I was a kid, I've never known him any different. And so it was very difficult for me when all the racist things came about because, you know, he ain't got a racist bone in his body. He's just old school Ron. I mean, yes, he made a racist comment and his mate off school, but he didn't mean it like that. And my parents, my dad, mum and dad come over from Jamaica in the late 50s. They've known Ron all my adult life, and they'll tell you he's not a racist. You know when somebody's being a racist, and Ron's not a racist. But it really affected him because people who he'd helped out, people who he'd looked after and genuinely had looked after, all looked after themselves, which is what people do, but it's sad, you know, because, you know, at the end of the day, if you know somebody not to be that way, like Dwight York should, like Fashanu should, like other players who he's looked after, you should stand up, even if it means you get some criticism. That's just the way it is. You should speak as you find.
Yeah.
And he must have liked you, didn't he, Ron? Because he signed you again and again and again. I think, was it 3 times he signed you?
Three times, and then I should have signed for Aston Villa. I'd agreed to go to Aston Villa from Sheffield Wednesday. The deal was done, but Ron went off to the World Cup. I had a phone call from my agent saying that Howard Wilkinson wanted to speak to me from Leeds United. They'd put the second highest bid. I think Alan Shearer went for $3.2 million. They put in a bid of $2.9 million for me. And my agent at the time said to me, you know, listen, you've got to do him the courtesy of at least going to speak to him. And I said, but I've agreed with Ron, the deal's done. And then I thought about it and I thought, well, you know, he's right, at least go and speak to Howard. And then I went to speak to Howard and I just felt that my kids were in school in Sheffield. I lived in Sheffield. I could commute. I didn't have to move. I liked what Howard was saying. Howard was a different type of a guy. And I felt that it was time for me to try something else. And I don't work for football clubs. I work for people. I don't work, and I'm in a fortunate position, but I choose to work for the people I want to work for. So when I signed for football clubs, when I went, if I didn't like the manager, I wouldn't sign them, irrespective of the club. So I really got on with Howard, and he ended up being my next door neighbour. But
how was that, living next to the manager?
Yeah. Kicking any balls over his garden?
No, we got big garden, mate.
How was it living next? Did you see him much? Did you go into training together?
No, never. But I got on really well. I still do. I still get on really well with Howard. And funny enough, it's strange to say this, that Howard and Ron are very, very similar. Very similar. Yes, they like to dress smart. They're always immaculate. But Howard's the side of, right, Howard, you won't get in to know Howard unless you get in his magic circle. Right. That's locked off. That's locked off to everybody unless you're in his magic circle. But if you get in his magic circle, he's fun. He likes to wear his clobber and he likes to have a banter the same as Ron. Ron's just flamboyant and out there.
Yeah. So something, I think Tony DiRigo told us this, that Howard Wilkinson liked to play a game of like imaginary golf where he would go, right, you're on the tee now, where you're driving, and you've got to explain, I hit it 200 yards, just on the fairway, just near the rough. Did he ever that happen?
He's never done that with me. He's never done that with me. But he's a former school teacher. So he's very analytical in everything he does. He's very knowledgeable in the game of football. And whenever he says anything to you, and this is why I have a lot of respect for him, whenever he says anything to you, it's not just said, it's backed up. Yeah, you know, yeah. When I went there, I didn't want to mark zonal. I've never marked zonal in my career. And I'd said to him when we the first game, and I said, you know, Gaffer, I'm not comfortable with allowing Tony Adams to have a run on me. And the lads were going, oh, I can't, for fuck's sake, now we're gonna be out all day doing set pieces morning and afternoon. But he did. But what he did is he doesn't just say things; he backed it up. And we never conceded a lot of goals from set pieces because everybody understood what their job was within that. And to mark zonal, you have to have good headers of the ball, and we did have good headers of the ball, so it actually worked for us.
Did you ever? Because I feel from you, you don't mind standing up to a manager. Did you ever worry about like standing up for yourself and in those situations with Howard Wilkinson? Because there'd be players that wouldn't want to.
No, never at all. That's the problem with today's game now. I think players are too comfortable. Not all players, but I think a lot of players are comfortable in the game because they earn too much money. They're not prepared to challenge the manager, which you should challenge the manager. If you don't agree on something, you should say something. You should be prepared to challenge other players if they're not doing it. And they should be able to take that in the right way, not taking it personal. We get paid a lot of money, especially now in this day and age. The game's gone a long way from the ordinary man in the street now. It's expensive to take your two kids. So at least the worst they should expect is you're giving 110%. So if players aren't doing that, I think other players should get onto other players. You don't see enough of it in today's game. You just don't see it.
Would you be happy to, after a game in the dressing rooms, are there big set two rows and stuff?
We used to have set twos before the games, half time and after the games. and sometimes in the pub afterwards. Yeah,
actually kick off? Would it be fist thrown?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say not fist, but heated arguments. I mean, Sheffield Wednesday were going through a bad run, and Viv and Danny called a meeting at Anran's, and the meeting got very heated because we said at the time Trevor Francis couldn't control our dressing room because he couldn't deal with the big characters in there. So we decided that we'd had to sort it out for ourselves, and there were words exchanged. Players were told, who was doing it, who wasn't doing it, and what we had to do and whatever. And that, and a lot of it, at the end of the day, trust me, a lot of it comes back down to the players.
Yeah.
You know, you can have the manager, but you, a lot of it comes back down to the players, because the players now get the managers the sack. Yeah. That's as simple as it is. They get them the sack. If they don't tools, they get them the sack. You sign a player now, you sign him on X amount of pounds, he's not happy, he downs tools. What, you can't just get him out, because it's not as simple as that. And he won't leave. So what's easier to do? Get rid of seven or eight players or get rid of the manager?
Yeah.
And that's what happens.
Speaking of, like, fighting, where, if it kicked off in the tunnel, where would you be? Would you be right down the front slinging the fists, or would you kind of wait back?
Well, I always come out last anyhow, so... But we get involved, don't worry about that. But I always come out last, didn't you?
Yeah. So. I found that so that you would come out of the tunnel last. And you played...
Unless I was skipper.
But you also played with Paul Ince, who had the same superstition, didn't he?
Yeah, we did.
How did that work?
Yeah, well, to be fair, when we were at England, so although I prefer to come out last, you know, Ince was in the England team before me, so there is an hierarchy, if you like. So I was happy to let Ince come out last and I come in...
Second last.
Yeah. But that wasn't a problem.
Let's go back to the start then. You're at West Brom. You then get... You move to Sheffield Wednesday.
Yeah.
How do you find out that move's going to happen? Like, how do they come to you and they say you're moving, or do you have a say in this? Or?
Yeah, well, it was kind of a bit of a shock, really. You know, everything was going great at West Brom. And then I got a phone call, I think it was on the Sunday, to say I got a report to the ground on the Monday. So I'm thinking, fucking hell, what have I been up to? You know, this, that and the other. And then reported on the Monday. But as I get to the ground, Bugsy Burrows was there and so was Steve Bort. And they told us, oh, the club's skint, so they're selling us. So Bugsy went in first. He said he was off to Liverpool. Steve Bort come out and said he was off to Wolves. And then they called me in and they said, oh, these are your options. So I had a long chat with Ken Bates. But I've never been, I'll be honest with you, and this is... The most hypocritical thing I can say to you is that I've never been a fan of London. I like coming into London for a weekend, have a night out, go and see a show. But to come and live in London, it never appealed to me. But now I live in Shanghai, 23 million people, and live in an apartment.
What was Ken Bates like to meet with?
Well, I mean, I never met him. I mean, I know Ken, as he happens, anyhow. You know, we spoke on the phone. He told me what he was going to do and this, that, the other. But then Nobby came in to see me and he says, what are you thinking of doing? And I said, I don't really know. I said, London's not really for me. He said, well, don't even think about it. He said, get up the road, go with Sheffield Wednesday where Ron Atkinson is. He said, I know they're going to get relegated. He said, but you know, the big man will sort that out. And that's what I did. And I had 9 fantastic years there. Really, I mean, not just football, in my personal life. It was just a fantastic time.
It's a great Sheffield Wednesday team that got together there.
Fantastic. Great team, personalities, you know, everything about the team gelled. It was just fantastic. It was a fun team to be a part of. Yeah. Really was, both off and on the pitch.
And I guess you join, what was it, in February 1989. 1991, you get to the League Cup final, but you miss it through suspension. And is it right that Ron Atkinson said to you before the game, you need to have your game of your life today? And it's you weren't even playing.
Yeah, what happened was we were looking to get promoted that season. So I wasn't even thinking about the cup final when we were playing Portsmouth away. I wasn't thinking the cup final's in 2 weeks' time. I was just thinking it's a league game, we need to win. That's it. So, you know, we were losing 1-0 and it was a reckless challenge. It really was a reckless challenge. I mean, I had no complaints about getting a red card, you know what I mean? It was just frustration about the game, really. And then I walked in and Ron come in, he was going ballistic. Do you know what you fucking done? You're going to miss the cup final and this, that and the other. And I went, oh, no. So we went down, Ron and I went down to see the FA, because I honestly believe that for big games, cup finals, that you only get... Sometimes great players go through their whole lifetime without playing in a major cup final. I think unless you're in really serious trouble, I think you should be allowed to play in the cup final. That's my personal opinion. But the FA turned down Ron's request and my request to play. So that was what it is.
What was cup final day like then? Did you go down with the team?
Yeah, no, I went down. Ron called me in about 5 days before and said to me, I need you to play the best game you've ever played. And I said to him, Ron, I ain't fucking playing. So he said to me, no. He said, listen, the lads are gutted you're not playing. He said, I'm gutted you're not playing. But he said, if you're down and moping around and whatever, then it's going to affect the old mood. He said, you need to be you, right? And he said, the boys will take care of the rest for you. And he said, don't worry, you'll play many more cup finals. You'll go back and play at Wembley many more times in the future. But he said, you need to be like that with the lads. And the lads made it easy for me. I mean, I was obviously gutted to not be playing, but the lads made it easy for me because they were a great set of lads. And I was genuinely pleased when they won. I was pleased for them. I was pleased for the club. I mean, obviously, I got a medal because I played in every round. It didn't feel the same because I didn't play there, and I have got a winner's medals. But I did play in every round. So it was sad from a personal point of view, but for everybody else, for the boys, for the club, for the fans. The fans gave me an unbelievable reception when I walked out on the pitch. You know, I'll never forget that. So, you know, at the end of the day, these things happen, don't they?
On the subject of suspensions, you nearly got a suspension. Well, you escaped drug suspension. Is this right? You used to smoke marijuana between the games.
No, I never used to smoke as a regular occurrence. But I mean, this one Thursday, I had a spliff. And I mean, it's not a performance-enhancing drug. It's not like, you know, but I had been drug tested 2 weeks on the trot, so I thought it was an impossibility that we'd get drug tested at Crystal Palace again, and they picked me again to get drug tested. So
when would that have been? After the game?
Yeah, after the game.
Yeah.
So they picked me again.
Well,
it's 48 hours to come out your system. I mean, as I say, it's a social drug, if anything. It's not going to enhance your performance in any way. In other words, you know, so... But it still would have been a problem. So we averted that situation.
How did you avert that situation?
There was some pee in a jug, but it wasn't necessarily your pee.
Correct.
And speaking of like pre-match ritual, I mean, marijuana is not going to enhance your performance in a match. But is it right that part of your pre-match ritual would be to have a shot of brandy before?
Yeah, I always used to have. Yeah, Sheffield Wednesday used to get it ready for me. Bob Gorrell and the girls in the sponsors lounge. And as I come out the tunnel, I used to go into the sponsors lounge. They'd have it on the side for me, have a shot of brandy, and I used to say to them, "I'll see you back in an hour and a half to collect the man of match award." And generally, I was.
How did that start?
No, I used to get really nervous before games. And, you know, my old man said to me once, he said, "Well, just have a shot of brandy to calm your nerves." And so I tried it, and it worked. It just gives you a rush.
Yeah.
It just calms your nerves. And then I just ran on the pitch.
Did you recommend it to any other players?
No, but Ince used to do it. Funny enough, when I used to line up with England, Ince used to have his miniature bells. Bank before he
got the whole little mini bottles.
Yeah,
that's a lot, isn't it?
Ince used to have his miniature.
Did people know you were doing it even on England duty?
Well, it wasn't something. I mean, they knew at Sheffield Wednesday, obviously, because I went in the sponsors' lane. But I mean, I think a lot of things like now, I'll be honest with you, a lot of things have become too much like borne out by the media, right? I mean, on a Friday night, I always used to go in my local pub and have a couple of pints of Guinness. Ron used to know that whenever I played, Howard Wilkinson used to know. Whenever I played, I always have a couple of drinks the night before the game. And listen, if you are fit, right, and I mean, if you've trained like I have and I train really hard, on a Friday I would train in the morning, I'd sleep in the afternoon, you know, I'd go and have a couple of pints of Guinness, get to bed. If I don't play well the next day, it isn't because of two pints of Guinness.
Yeah.
But it's people's perception. I actually am more likely to play well because of the two pints of Guinness.
Howard Wilkinson didn't understand it, did he? He tried to make you cut down.
No. What Howard said to me when he signed me for Leeds, he said to me, "Listen, I'm signing you, so I'm not saying it's an issue, right? But he said, I've heard about your drinking," which, don't get me wrong, I'm not kidding anybody, I like a drink. But you cannot have played the amount of games I've played and played three games a week. I mean, if you look at my record at the football clubs, up until I decided to retire, I didn't retire because I had to, I retired because I wanted to. I played a lot of football matches and you can't play to that level and that standard. So it's like my wife said to me, she said, "Well, I always used to see you out drinking." I said, "Well, how does that work then? Because if you always used to see me out drinking, that means you were out. And you're a school teacher." Do you know what I mean? So it's people's perceptions, because somebody sees you out on a Wednesday night and they go, "Oh, well, I've seen Carlton Palmer out drinking." Well, we've just played on a Wednesday night, we've got Thursday off. So what's the problem with me going out and having a drink? If we played on a Saturday and we got Sunday off, what's the problem with me going out and a drink? To be fair, Sundays I like to drink on a Sunday. I used to take my kids horse riding and swimming. I have a few scoops in the afternoon, and that was me. I get back to work on Monday. That's the, you know, that was the way I worked, and I don't see that being an issue really. And in today's game, you can't even fart now without them getting on you. But you tell me now today in the game, name me a character today. There's no Gordon Strachans. There's no Cantonars. There's no characters in the game. I don't see one person I would call in the Premier League a character because they're not allowed to be.
Well, that's why we've got this podcast, Carl. Yeah. All the characters are on here. That's where they are now.
Exactly. All retired.
Did you go out? Did you drink with the other teammates?
Yeah, who were you drinking?
Yeah. But, I mean, listen, I never, and even now, you ask my missus, I never ring people up and say, right, I'm going for a drink or whatever. I drink in a certain place, people know where I drink. If they want to come and join me, they come and join me. That's down to them.
Yeah. So this is before the days of mobile phones, right? You just have to turn.
But even now, my missus says to me, I'm not a mobile phone person. I'm not really into it. Like, so if I've said to you, I'm old school. If I say to you, I'm going to meet you at 7 o'clock in the rising sun, I don't need to take my phone. We've said 7 o'clock in the rising sun. I will be there for 7 o'clock. That's it. And I can't get my head around. I really can't. And I find it really difficult. Like, so if we've made an arrangement to meet at 7 o'clock and you were to call me at 7:15, A, I'd have already fucking gone and I would left my phone. But I couldn't understand why you would change the arrangement.
Yeah.
If we've already made, you know, like if we, like I said to Lucy, if we've made arrangements to go out with dinner with people at a certain place and they've said they want to change to go somewhere, well, I like, fuck them, let them go there then. We go with.
That cuts through as well from your attitude as a footballer. This is like, I think it should be done this right way, you know.
Yeah.
When you like calling out other players as well. You don't take any shit.
No, but I don't in life. It's black and white. It's simple. Listen, anybody can say whatever they want to say, and I hear this word, lucky. And all the people who are successful in life, they're lucky. No, all the people who are successful in life work damn hard. So what comes with that is that bit of luck. So you get that bit of luck coming your way because you are prepared to do the things that other people aren't prepared to do. And that's the difference. If you see successful people, like when I went to Leeds United, that opened my eyes. Gordon Strachan still playing at 40, Gary McAllister, Eric Cantona. They were all in training an hour before everybody started.
Yeah.
You know, warming up, practicing their drills, doing whatever. Mark Bright, training's finished, bag of balls, he'd be somebody cross him the ball, he'd be shooting and whatever. So when the people say they're lucky, I'm not saying we don't get luck, but it's amazing. All these people who are successful get their luck because they're prepared to go and do further than anybody else. That's a fact. Yeah. There's no way about it.
Because you hear this, like, you hear it about Cantona and then Beckham was certainly always practicing cricket.
Yeah.
And it does make you wonder, why aren't more footballers, you know, they can see that the top players are staying out there, they're training more.
I went to Aston Villa once, Martin O'Neill was manager, right? And we were talking about something, and Martin O'Neill said to me, he'd given the players off the afternoon. He said, name the two players who'll be outside at the back. And I couldn't think of the two players. And we walked round the back, and the two players that were out the back was Brad Friedel, what age did he play to?
Yeah.
And Ashley Young, who then got his move to Manchester United. So there's no coincidence. Look at Ronaldo, you know, still going at the age he is, scoring goals, and people think, oh, well, it's luck. It's not luck. It's not luck. So I'm not saying that everybody gets the same opportunity.
Yeah.
But at whatever level you are, and I've always said this to my kids, right, if you put the work in, right, you will get your due at whatever level it's supposed to be.
There's a bit of a theme this series that players who are application, who really try hard, and there's some who just have like unnatural ability.
Yeah.
Like Matt Letizia, who you played with at Southampton. I think you seem to have very different kind of like modes of operandi. Like he wouldn't train as much as you would train, presumably. Like how did you cope with that?
Matt Letizia is a talented footballer. And I've said this, and sometimes it's taken out of context, but I say it in truth, right? I've finished my career and I've done, without shadow of doubt, the best. I have no regrets. Surely Matt has regrets because I don't think he fulfilled his potential. And I'm not saying because he stayed at Southampton because he was a one-club player, right? But if you look at the players who have left Southampton to go on, Alan Shearer, Gareth Bale, to name two, who have gone on. So only Matt really knows whether he achieved his full potential as a player. I don't believe he did, because I seen him when I went there when he wasn't fit and then got fit and then nearly got back in the England side. And I thought, well, he should have gone on to a bigger stage than Test. But to do that, that puts you out your comfort zone.
Yeah.
So when I went to Leeds United, I wasn't guaranteed playing. I could have stayed at Sheffield Wednesday, guaranteed a playing every week. But I got David Batty, I got Gary McAllister. You know, they just won the league title. I wasn't guaranteed a playing. But you've got to take yourself out of that and then back yourself to improve. And the prime example of that in today's game is Jordan Henderson. He went to Liverpool, he went for big money. For me, nothing more than a bang average midfield player. But he went to Liverpool. I think Brendan Rodgers tried to offload him in a loan deal back to Fulham. He turned it down. He's grafted and grafted and grafted and turned himself into the player that he has become today, which is an exceptional midfield player.
Yeah.
And that's having the balls to say, no, I can be better than this and I can work at it and I can improve and I want to challenge myself to do that. And he's the prime example in modern day. His transformation of him as a player is tenfold.
Yeah. When you were young and you were starting out and you were at West Brom, did you think in your mind, because you obviously feel very driven, did you think, I'm going to play for England?
No chance. Listen, to have played for West Brom was a dream come true. The club I supported as a kid, being on the terraces and whatever, becoming a footballer was a dream come true. Everything was a bonus for me. This is the difference. I'm under no illusion about my ability and what I was capable of and what I wasn't. And that's the difference between me and other players. I knew what my game was about and I knew what I was capable of doing. Mm-hmm. I can stop good players from playing. That was never an issue to me, because my fitness was that good that I could stop good players from playing. And I played alongside good players who could deal with the football, right? How far that would take me, I didn't know. But I used to come in every day, work as hard as I could. I used to come in every match day, give it 100%, you know? And I was lucky enough to have the career that I was able to have.
Do you think... So I think playing with you, like speaking to you now, it must have upped the game of the rest. Like, the team must have...
Well, it's a problem if you were in the dressing room with me. It's a problem because I, you know, put it this way: if Lucy and I play Scrabble now in China, there's murder on. We have to ring.
It's so competitive.
Oh, we have to ring her mother back, get the Oxford dictionary. And my wife's an head teacher. But it's murder on because I want to win. I want to win.
And I think that's why managers kept re-signing you, because they liked you. They liked the fact you were a leader in the dressing room and someone you could rely on.
Well, certainly when Dave Jones signed me at Southampton, I think they were 7 points adrift at the bottom of the league. There were players there like Matt who were comfortable and he needed them shaking up. And that was what I was brought in to do.
Did you have a plan to go in and shake it up in that situation?
I know what I have to do to get other players going, and I know what we have to do to win football matches. Michael Jordan's father said to him once, it was the NBA finals, and he was coming in, I think it was a break at half-time, he was coming in, and his dad grabbed him, and he was moaning at everybody, he was moaning at the referee, he was moaning at the rest of the players. And his dad turned round to him and said, listen, son, you're the best player on the team, lead, and the rest would follow, right? I wasn't the best player on the team, but I knew that what I could affect other players in my team. So that's what I had to do, and get around people in a positive way, right? Yeah. And that's what I tried to do. I can honestly say I've had fallouts within training and within managers, you know, and teammates within the context of the game. But generally, throughout my career, I've got on with everybody.
Yeah.
I just want to win.
So talking of wanting to win, what must have been a really tough season then was 1993 Sheffield Wednesday.
Yeah.
Two cup finals.
Yeah.
League Cup.
Both against Arsenal.
And we beat Arsenal in the league as well that season. So, you know, it was a difficult one. I think what we all knew that whoever won the first game would have psychological advantage. Actually, we won the last league game against them going into the final. So we fancied our chances of actually doing what Arsenal did in winning the two. In the first game, in all fairness, there was nothing much in the game, but Arsenal deserved to win. And it was a problem for us because we picked up injuries. And instead of me, and I think it worked in Arsenal's favour because Arsenal had a few injury problems, but that I had to go and play at centre-back. So we lost that energy in the middle of the park.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I actually made the mistake for the goal. But we didn't deserve to win that game. In the FA Cup, we battered Arsenal. I mean, on the Saturday, before it went to a replay, should never have gone to a replay. You know, the chances we missed, chance after chance. And then we went to the replay on the Thursday night. It was, we had chances, we were the better side again. And unfortunately, with seconds to go to penalties, Boldy scores, Edo, Woodsy should maybe tip it over, but yeah, things happen and it wasn't to be, but, you know, it was disappointing for us. We should have at least got away with one of those trophies. So whilst it was disappointing to go to Wembley in two major cup finals, and I think we finished, what, fifth or sixth in the league.
Have you kept your runners-up medal? Are you someone who can look back on that fondly, or are you, your competitive instinct makes you feel like...
Well, do you know what? It's interesting. Because I've been so busy since I've finished playing football, I haven't really looked at anything.
Really? So was it all in your loft?
No. It's you know, funny enough, because we've now just bought this new house, we've started taking a few bits out. But I haven't really, in all honesty, you know, looked back and sat down at my career. I haven't, because I just haven't had the time. I've always been on the go with something else. And I look forward to doing that in years to come. I really do.
Have you got all your England caps as well?
Yes. Yes, I've kept everything.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, kept everything.
Let's talk about your England career a little bit. So you made your debut away to the Soviet Union, essentially, in Moscow.
Yeah.
How was that as an experience?
Well, the thing was how it all came about. So I got a phone call from Graham Taylor on a Sunday saying that he was going to pick me. But we've got the Sheffield United derby coming up the following week after the Russia game.
Yeah.
So that was the semi-final at Wembley. So Trevor Francis had pulled me and said, unfortunately, I can't play. So there was a big row over that. Because I said to him, I said, like, you know, it's different if I wasn't going to play, but Graham Taylor had confirmed that I was going to play.
And so do you think I've got to push this through? With
No, there's no way I'm not going. I'm going to play. So we ended up having a row, but then I decided to approach it a different way. By saying, like, you know, to him, well, listen, Trevor, what would you do if it was the other way around? If it was you, you play for your country. In the end, he agreed. And so, obviously, off I went to play, had a good game. We drew 2-2, ended up getting injured.
Oh.
Split my toe open.
Yeah.
So there's no way I can play the following week. Absolutely no way. So it was, it ended up being a nightmare. Actually, when I came out, you see me come out before the game. So I come out really early before the game and they try freezing a part of my toe, but it still can't work. So in the end, I played with the foot frozen. I had to have it frozen.
How does that work? But there was a spray, is it? Or?
No, injection.
Oh my God.
Injection
that is...
like this, going right underneath the sole of the foot to freeze the foot. I got 90 minutes. And then if you actually watch the game, you see me running down the tunnel where the dock comes down because it goes into extra time to freeze it again.
Oh my God. That is horrific.
No, it was,
God.
It was.
And does it affect your play that you've got?
Well, to be honest with you, my foot was numb. Right, yeah. And just takes a bit of while to get used to it because obviously you can't feel it. And then after that, I think the adrenaline and everything about the game because the game is so big. So I always wind Brian Dean up and say, fucking hell, we beat you and I played against you with one leg and you didn't get it.
How did it feel when it thawed out? It must have been
an
agony.
It was a nightmare because I had to have it restitched. It was a nightmare. And it went on for weeks because I had to keep playing like that until I could get to the end of the season and sort it out.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.